Welcome to the Plant Cunning Podcast,
where we explore our relationship to plants, other people, and the mysteries of nature.
Coming to you from the High Allegheny Plateau in central New York,
we are your hosts, A.C. Staubel
and Isaac Hill. Okay, so today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we have the legendary Daniel Ingram. Daniel wrote Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha. And in this episode, we talk about enlightenment, meditation, fire casino, all sorts of interesting things. And I think you're going to enjoy it. Before we get to the episode, I just want to let you know, if you don't know already, that we are having the second annual Plant Cunning Conference at our small farm in central New York on the last weekend of July, the 26th through 28th. You can get your tickets now at plantcunningconference.com. Early bird tickets will last through the end of May. We have some amazing speakers, including Sevensong, Michael Bryan, Rebecca Beyer, Zamboni Funk, Lisa Fazio, and many more. And the keynote will be by Pam Montgomery. Pam is also currently enrolling for her co-creative partnership with Nature Mentorship Program, which you can find at wakeuptonature.com/co-creative-partnership-with-nature. AC will be helping with that, running some of the IT and tech stuff and helping with the community there. So check that out and get on that while you can. She's starting that soon. Also, I am still doing my Vedic astrology readings for donation. I can look at your chart, look at the karmic level, and offer some basic remedies. If you're interested in that sort of thing, let me know at info@plantcunning.com, and I'll get a date to read your chart with you. Okay, so make sure to like, subscribe, share, comment, all those fun things. Give us a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts. Share with your friends. And follow us on Instagram, TikTok, Facebook, all those places. So thank you very much for continuing to be part of the Plant Cunning audience. And I hope you enjoy this episode. Today on the Plant Cunning Podcast, we are honored to have Daniel Ingram. Daniel is the author of Mastering the Core Teachings of the Buddha, which I first found out about in 2008, and it caused quite a splash. You know, there's some controversy because you made the claim that you actually found what the Buddha found, or something like the Buddha found, arhantship. So that was a challenge to some people, but I think it also spurred a lot of movement and growth and inspiration. Mm-hmm. But you've done a lot of other things too. You're a ER doctor, or you have been an ER doctor. Mm-hmm. You mean musician, lived in India. You've done a lot of things all over the world. But I looking at your updated book and at your earliest memories, you said that one of your earliest memories was being in a flower garden and trying to remember the Latin names for all of these plants, which you should have known
as like a small child.
Yep.
So were you a plant person in a last life? Are you a plant person in this life?
It's a good question. So that the memory of that is actually quite compelling and very, very strong. And it's very clear. I remember exactly where I was standing. And this is in Waubun, Massachusetts, Jeffrey Circle, where we lived at the time. And I remember the walkway and the plants and like, wait, why can't I should know all of these. Like, yeah. It was like they were slipping away, fading away. And this is not an uncommon thing for kids to report with these sorts of, you know, sense of wispy, fading, past lifey kinds of things. So interesting. So I don't know, but that's a data point of a memory. And then in this life, my wife is really the plant person. So I help in some mechanical sorts of ways, but she's the one who really communes with them and tends to them. I'm more of a support person for that.
Cool. Nice.
But you are a healer in this life. So one of the questions that I like to start out the podcasts that we have with people who are more on the spiritual side of things is, what do you know for sure? It's a simple question.
It's just a low ball warm up, you know?
Yeah. What do I know for sure? So I'm something of a David Humean, who is a British empiricist, Scottish actually, but that falls in the tradition of British empiricists. And the empiricists basically said this immediate sensate reality is clearly the first basis of all other extrapolations of knowledge. And I'm very much on the same page with them. There are clearly colors. This is self-evident, occurring, being experienced somehow. There are bodily sensations. There are sounds. There are thoughts occurring, transient, ephemeral, immediate, causal, kind of mysterious how they actually happen. but that seems straightforward enough. And then everything beyond that is some sort of extrapolation with fading shades of certainty. So that's the one thing I think that we're likely to agree on. And I think that the empiricists were right in this regard. And it's also a useful assumption for insight practices or vipassana, that this moment is the first and last basis of that's the epistemic or, you know, frame of knowledge for insight practices. And I found that very useful.
Okay. So basically that phenomena is happening.
Yeah.
But is it, do you see it's possible to know what the phenomena is that is happening? Like, I mean, colors come through and are filtered by the brain and sounds too, like interpreted by the brain.
Certainly that's the model we're currently working with based on things we've extrapolated from immediate sensations. And it's a perfectly useful model for some types of work. So I am a strict ontologically agnostic empirical with a big E, empirical little e pragmatist. And what that means is I hold all my frameworks for what reality is in some strict sense extremely lightly. And I look at them through three lenses. One is empiricist, like based on my immediate experience, can I empirically, in the sense of a reproducible scientific experiment, demonstrate that that frame has some sort of utility, pragmatism, for some kind of problem or type of working? We actually all do this all the time. It's not particularly interesting. You think about, hopefully, your taxes very differently than you think about your relationship. There are some people who don't, maybe, but they usually run into trouble if they can't code switch in that kind of way. And so these are very, very different frames in terms of what we think we know, how we know it, what we consider a basis of knowledge, what is true, and ways of looking at those sorts of truths from a lens of utility that we can show in our experience. And so we all code switch all the time. I just have made something of a formal session about recognizing that. And so the models you just saying that there is a brain somewhere, that brain is through meat, and, you know, that there is, that these sensations imply that there is a meat brain through which, you know, optical and other systems are filtered through, extrapolating, you know, what then you would generally think of as photons of various levels of energy, all of which were measured by machines. You know, that we assume there are so many nanometers or so many electron volts or whatever of power in these photons that then create certain things in the vitamin A based retina receptors in the eye that make certain impressions and eventually aggregated in the occipital lobe to create the sense of, well, that's a useful frame for certain types of things. And if you're an ophthalmologist or a neurosurgeon or, you know, some sort of optical scientist or, you know, other types of work, it might be a very useful way of looking at the world. And sure, a reasonable one. Or you could say sensations come first, out of which we extrapolate all of those things that we can't directly know, you know, and there's other ways to look at it.
Yeah. So you're saying models shape, well, in a way, are how we understand reality, but they also can shape reality, and it's based on utility. So like
for me, and I think for most people.
Yeah. I find the problem is when people just have one frame of reference or one like reality tunnel, and then that's what they think is the only thing. Like in
although, well, maybe that's working for them. Maybe they're the kind of person that really needs a single model in that sense of an internal consistency, and maybe pragmatically in their own experience, they have done the experiment and found that more than one model they find confusing, hypocritical, contradictory, disorienting, not particularly valuable. So maybe in their experience, they've done the experiment and that's what they've found so far. Okay.
That's a good point. Mm-hmm. But so the models, I found it helpful to switch between models too, because there's like with a materialist, like reductionist model, for instance, you can do a lot of really helpful things. Like you can manipulate the material world to a very high degree. But it also leaves out a lot of, you know, meaning and purpose and all sorts of other things. So how do you see the utility of these different systems of thought, of worldview for you? I mean, I guess you already answered that to a certain degree, but.
Well, and I'm also sort of a funny one in this regard. So I'm going to flex a little bit, for better or for worse. And having had kind of like all of the experiences multiple times in extraordinarily strong and compelling ways, with that profound sense of noesis and knowing, like the sense that all is one, all is divine consciousness, all is love, all is energy, all is meaningless, all is void, all is emptiness, all is mere sensate phenomena crashing on impersonally as always. There is no time. All sensations of time and future are just, you know, thoughts that arise now. There is no space that is even stable. And that also that I have been reborn in past lives, as we were talking about earlier, and reborn now. So the problem is, if you have enough of these experiences strongly enough, eventually you start to recognize, wait a second, the worldview that accompanies each of those can be quite compelling. Yeah. And they cannot simultaneously all be true in any ordinary logical way of thinking about the world. Each of them may have their compellingness as they arise. And had I only had like experiences in kind of one neighborhood of those, it would be nearly impossible, based on the conditioning of how strong these senses of knowing are, to not adopt that worldview. All is cosmic consciousness, all is emptiness and meaningless, all is whatever, you know, depending on how you want to, you know, where you were clustering. But having been across the wide range of it, eventually you start to get the joke that the mind is capable of producing incredibly compelling meanings to explain its experiences, all of which cannot possibly be true from any logical point of view, or all of which may some kind of be true from some sort of meta epistemic something, ontological something. And then at that point, what are you left with? Nothing I found particularly satisfying in terms of a coherent system or something to hang my hat on and say, that's the one. But certainly lots of interesting perspectives that might be able to be brought in for working with certain people or thinking about the world in certain ways or dealing with magic versus my taxes versus medicine versus psychology versus, you know, because different frames might be useful for different things. And it's nice to have a bunch of stuff in the toolbox, and it helps you at least relate to the basic experiences that people might have had if they're a, you know, cosmic consciousness is the answer, or this is all an emergent property of insensate particles and forces, or whatever their favorite is. Okay, I can relate to them because I've been there. Fine.
So from your perspective, there's no absolute truth.
So
from a perspective, there's absolute truth. From another perspective, there's not.
So it depends on what you're trying to do. So the mythic resonance of the word absolute truth can be super compelling, right?
Yeah,
this is a
yeah.
very, very compelling mythic thing to say. It's got that charge of, right? And then whichever thing you pick of the various options, you know, this is a matrix, this is solipsism, this is all the dream of the great god Vishnu or whatever.
Yeah.
Depending on which of those you pick, you're going to have a really different relationship to reality. And you can try that on and see what you think. If that is ultimate reality, wow, okay, then. So some things I do think apply. So I think sensations are transient.
Yeah.
I think that's true. I've never had a sensation that lasted forever. So they, although the sense this is eternal has arisen, it always then, that sensations would then dissolve, even if it said at the time it was eternal. Okay. So sensations are transient. This, I think, we can reasonably hang our transient hats on. And so that's a thing that experiences, that is, it is nicer to have the perceptual mode where experiences know themselves where they are, rather than being filtered through the sense that some of the sensations somewhere near the center are perceiving other sensations, having perceived reality both ways. I prefer the one where everything just knows itself where it is. That is a nicer way of perceiving reality and seems, when it occurs, more clear, for better or for worse. Not meaning to make any supremacist or ultimate ontological statements based on that. I do find, let's see, what else do I find? That some people derive a lot of benefit from ontological frames that involve a sense of a luminous superspace or an all-pervasive stable awareness, at least for some periods of time. Based on my own experience, I found that compelling for some period of time and eventually found it useful to be able to see that come and go, like all other sensations from which it was extrapolated. So those are just personal experiences that you know, pragmatically I can say I prefer the one to the other. These are personal preferences. How do those extrapolate to universal ideals? You can consult the traditions and get a wide range of dogmatically orthodox, zealous answers.
So what about the experience of subjectivity or like the observer, like who the you that observes all these sensations and everything that exists?
So the sense that there was actually a center point anywhere to be found in experience dropped away about 21 years ago now, almost. And in April of 2003, while I was on retreat, and that hasn't re-arisen as something that seems true in experience since then. So everything just happens as it is, where it does, knows itself as it occurs. Kind of like if you had a three-dimensional monitor and every pixel on the monitor knew itself just where it was.
Right.
Including the sense of perspective, right? Mm-hmm. There you are. There you are, right? Perspective is still kind of built into what the sensations of what the three-dimensional pixel screen that you can't find can do. But perspective is not the same thing as subjectivity. So, and clearly the sensations of my eyelids and the sensations of my sinuses and the sensations of my eyeballs are not actually observing those sensations there on the monitor, for example. Those sensations on the monitor are over there, right? And then these sensations of eyes and perception and focusing and, you know, are over here. That's pretty straightforwardly clear. And I prefer this mode of perceiving reality to the previous one. It seems vastly more, yeah, it's just preferable, regardless of whether or not you say this is some ultimate something and what label you want to put on it. Now, that doesn't mean that at points I haven't put labels on this, like arhatship and realization and things, which politically and linguistically do all kinds of fascinating causal things in the world. And, you know, take that for what it's worth. Warnings, pros and cons, risk benefits, alternatives.
That is what you would call enlightenment.
That's what I call enlightenment most of the time when asked about it. Sure. And really forced to say, what do you think enlightenment is? Yeah, that.
Mm-hmm. So for you to get to that point, it took you, I mean, not really that long, actually, all things considered compared to.
Well, I don't know. I started on the spiritual journey when I was a young kid. I was having blissful meditative experiences as a 3 and 4 year old and maybe earlier. I don't know. I can't remember. But, you know, and have my first major energetic, you know, blowout around 14 or 15, something like that. I know that by the house we lived in. And so then crashed around for, you know, 17 years on the path until finally the thing, you know, through a lot of adventures flipped over. It didn't feel like a short time to me. Maybe it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But you're still pretty young comparatively to many people who are searching their entire lives.
Sure. That's true. I got lucky. I had some talent. I found really good teachers and frameworks. I had some good support. I had some financial privilege. I had, you know, some other stuff that helped.
What are your main lineages and who are some of your teachers?
Oh, good question. I started out meditating with Christopher Titmus and Sharda Rogel and Jose Rezig, and then did a number of other retreats with Sharda and Christopher, as well as Norman Feldman and Sabana Barzagi and Yvonne Weir and other people, Bhante Gunaratana, Bill Hamilton, Kenneth Folk, you know, little bits of here and there with some various Dzogchen-y, Tibetan-y kind of people and some Zen people and some other Hindu Vedanta people and a lot of books, a lot of reading, a lot of intensive retreats. And yeah, then Mahasi people, Upandita Jr. and Sada Urujinda. And yeah, Bill Hamilton was also highly influenced by Mahasi Sydow, as was Kenneth Folk. Yeah, and then a lot of stuff in magic, like, influenced by the chaoticists and some of the grimoire stuff, although it's not as much my cup of tea.
Yeah, yeah.
And modern sort of Wiccan-y fusion traditions, and then a bunch of old Chinese kind of Taoist-y stuff. And yeah, it's a range.
Yeah.
So what do you think gave you the drive to sit down and do all that meditation that intensely? Because it was, you know, many retreats of going in there and just putting all you had into it.
Wow. What gave me the drive? So the roads to power is an interesting question. What drove me? I was driven, I think, by three or four primary things. One was an intense frustration that when I read The Dancing Woolly Masters and compared it to my own experience, I was entirely convinced that it was way more true, that everything was just happening on its own as part of an interdependent universe. And I instead had the sense that I was a separate subject in control with some sort of agency, kind of, sort of, but not really, but sort of. And that book that was given to me by my either eighth or ninth grade science teacher, Mr. Smith, was very helpful. I had him 2 years in a row, so I can't remember which year he gave it to me. And then that like intellectually, like I am quite sure, I was intellectually convinced that I was not a subject. I was just part of the interdependent universe, but experientially, I was quite sure I was at least seemed to have at least some kind of control, even though when the first time I ever sat down on a cushion, I recognized the amount of control I had of even basic thoughts or emotions or feelings or sensations was vanishingly small, if at all. So, you know, and that kind of like, so why that should have been so jarring to me as a somewhat neuroatypical person, but it was. And that's the first thing. The second thing was the challenge, right? It seemed like incredibly cool thing to be able to learn once I found out this was actually something you could learn and there were maps and they actually kind of worked and the techniques led to stuff and you could go deeper and do the experiment and replicate the stuff in these old books up there. So that I was totally obsessed with that for whatever gonzo type A alpha male obsessed with being a Renaissance person who accomplishes and masters lots of stuff 20 something year old, right? So so that the challenge of it. And then there was the sense of suffering. Like there was very much the sense, as soon as my first major energetic opening had happened, I had to find something. I had to find something. I was on the path even 10 years before I knew there was a path to be on. And I had all the signs of someone who was seeking, looking, questing, thinking, trying to, what the heck, where, you know, it was suburban North Carolina in the 80s. It wasn't a bastion of accessible new age culture, at least to me. Maybe there were, pockets of it there somewhere. Mm-hmm. And so those were some of the things that drove me.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so you're also in Mastering the Core Teaching of the Buddha. One of the big things besides saying that you're an arhat is the insight, the stages of insight. And that was a big thing because a lot of people who are like if folks don't know about this, in the like shallow end of mindfulness, they're not aware what mindfulness can actually lead to. And there can be a lot of darkness and a lot of dark night of the soul territory, but there also can be awakening, which a lot of people in the Buddhist scene at that time kind of didn't really talk about. So you talked about both ends of that. But this map of the stages of insight, do you think that it's obviously applicable to you and a lot of people that you know? Do you think it's applicable to other practitioners from other traditions who are or not?
Definitely some. So there are definitely some people who in their own experience, regardless of where they're coming from or even outside of a tradition, when they encounter the maps, which are way older than me, right? They come out of Comprehensive Manual of Abhidhamma, Visuddhimagga, Vimuttimagga, and actually you can find their prototypical forms in the Patthisamvidhimagga, which is part of the Kutaka Nikaya, which is some sort of later-ish text, Sariputta influence. Sorry, I'm just kind of rattling off a bunch of things. And you can even kind of find them in the origin story of the Buddha and the temptations by Mara. You can see a lot of the same stages echoed in a little bit more mythic form, even in his awakening story as he sat there on the cushion and went through all the interesting adventures before he woke up. So and these maps show up in a lot of other places. So I'm more of a kind of a lumper perennialist than some. And when I look at things like St. John of the Cross's Dark Night of the Soul, I cannot help but see incredibly clear parallels of the highs, lows, weirds, and openings and things of the path. When I look at the Philokalia or the Graces of Interior Prayer, which is Catholic and Eastern Orthodox or Greek Orthodox, when I look at Sufi maps like Journey to the Lord of Power by Ibn Arabi or the Conference of the Birds or some of these older maps. When I look at Rumi, I can't help but see stuff like this. When I look at Kabir and plenty of other traditions, the Hero's Journey, some of the Greek magical papyri, you see this stuff again and again and again in a way that if you are something of a rough perennialist like me, recognizing that there is a lot of variance and there is a lot of variables and it's complicated and all of that, that very often these maps in some kind of form that looks kind of like this rough sequence of highs, lows, weirds, openings, plateaus, and stuff with some cyclic elements and works for a whole lot of people. Now, there have been exceptions and people who either I'm seeing that the maps apply to them and they totally don't think so, or when they tell their story, I'm just like, that just does not seem to fit the pattern. So as a naturalist and a scientist, I'm very interested not only in the things that kind of fit the pattern, but the things that really kind of don't. And like from a descriptive point of view, from that like naturalist wandering into the jungle and just describing every type of bug and rock and stick and leaf and, you know, lichen, fern and all that kind of stuff, like, what are all these things out that happen out there in human experience? And the EPRC, the Emergent Phenomenology Research Consortium, which is my primary project that I spend most of my time on these days, helping to, you know, work on, support, run, network, et cetera, is all about basically what's the phone book? How do you come up with an expansive taxonomic system, the phone book of all the stuff that happens out there? And what are the patterns and what do people describe and what are all the variants? And can we use powerful techniques to, and a lot of just raw brute force data collection to wrap our heads around what we're actually seeing out there, regardless of anybody's sense of orthodoxy? And then how do the orthodox models apply to that? When are they useful? When are they not? And then how do you language that in a way that scales to the global clinical mainstream? So that was kind of a long answer to that question. But
for sure. But that's very interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it also brings to my mind the you know, the question of one mountain or many mountains. And in the way I see it, like, everybody is their own mountain in a way. Mm-hmm. But what do you think? Are there many mountains, or is there just one mountain?
I'm not a many mountain or one mountain person. I think there are common elements that you just see again and again and again that are kind of described, and then there are individual variants. So it's I'm not sure I would call them mountains as well as aspects, some of which I do think are pretty much universal. That reality is transient and immediate. I think that's going to have a universal thing that you just keep finding again. And then it's a question of, just people describe it as true self or no self or cosmic consciousness or whatever. So there are some descriptive differences of stuff that, as something of a perennialist lumper, I think that, you know, that experience is immediate and transient. I think that's kind of hard to argue with. Like, and that there's something in that that the full acceptance and comprehension of that can lead to something that might reasonably describe as some kind of realization. That said, there's a whole lot of interesting add-ons, adjuncts, things that you find out there. And there's do seem to be some places that seem to have kind of a compelling stability to them, like the all-pervading, luminous, stable, eternal, silent all ground is one of the compelling endpoints versus the everything is impermanent type, like I do. And those kinds of debates have split whole traditions. Right. So, you know, I don't think we're going to resolve those today.
You can't really know what somebody else knows or has experienced. I mean,
not easily. We're starting to do the very beginning hints of the neuroscience of that. But again, it's very early days.
Yeah. So another thing in regards to maps and cycles, I'm interested in cycles myself as an astrologer. And I can see in like timing systems and like Vedic astrology, it's a fractal in a certain way. You know, there's a larger cycle, there's smaller cycles within that and smaller cycles in within those. Is that the same for the progress of insight? And do you find like, so for you, there's maybe larger cycles of that. And then when you're practicing, there's more intense cycles. But is somebody who's not practicing in that with the same intensity as you did, are they just kind of experiencing it as like one big cycle, which for you might be a smaller cycle? Or I don't know. I'm trying to see how like these maps relate to different practitioners too.
Those are really super important questions. And it has been noted again and again that maps like the stages of insight, it can apply at like a macro level, where like, where are you that month? And they can apply it like, where are you at that second or minute in your sit? And where are they in that phase of the retreat? So particularly when you go on retreat, the cycles and the cyclic nature of this does become more apparent and obvious. There's no question, although some people experience it in daily life with more clarity as well, but it's less common, right? So the average definitely gets moved way into the more obvious when people are on retreat. And then like the funny thing of like, you know, last night you were in this like wide place of opening, and then you wake up the next morning in the dark night. And during that sit, maybe you get back to some place of like wide opening, and then you sit down the next sit and you're starting in the dark night again, but you're sort of moving like, so you can get these kind of sawtooth patterns on retreat of going up and falling back and going up. But even within each sit and even within each moment and even within each fraction of experience, depending on how fractal perceptive you are or fascinated by fractal models, as I often have been, one can then see fractals within fractals, loops within loops, ups and downs within sine waves within sine waves, harmonics of a wide variety across years, months, days, seconds, fractions of a second. Yeah, all of that. So that's definitely a thing. And some people, those kinds of maps and models really work for them, and other people don't. But there are a number of people who are like, for years, they looked at like, oh, I saw that fractal chapter in your book and I thought it was just bullshit. And then I had this opening and now I'm totally seeing it. So, you know, that happens sometimes.
It also makes sense that if you're training your mind to be able to look very closely at phenomena and see the arising and passing away of each phenomena with very like high definition clarity, you're also going to be able to see those that phenomena happening more easily, more clearly.
Yeah,
But even,
no
you know,
question.
like I haven't done the kind of meditation you've done. I've done some other kinds of meditation, and I do have my own kind of retreats. Like I do more like solitary retreats where I'm just alone with myself for a week.
Okay.
And I can even see like, you know, the clarity from being there and then coming back. And then I say, I don't even want to sit at all. I don't want to, you know, like that. I see that happening, but it also, it doesn't seem as quite as linear or circularly linear as it seems from your map. You know what I mean? Like it's like sometimes you can go and then come back and then like you don't finish a full cycle, or it's like parts are out
Sure.
of place.
Oh yeah, all that happens. Sure. These maps are glitchy and certainly not perfect.
Okay. Yeah. So the other thing is, when you're using this kind of a map and you're using like the kind of meditation that you've done, is it like it seems as though those things kind of do go together. Like that kind of a map, that clear of a map, and the meditation focused specific, like the Vipassana type of meditation that you do.
I mean, actually,
So,
mostly I do fire casino when I go on retreats these days, but sure, I've done a lot of
okay.
Vipassana.
But to get to the awakening that you had, I mean, like, so the fire casino practice, do you see that as directly related to like the insight and the awakening, or is that more like a magical thing for you?
Well, I mean, so from my point of view, the awakening happened 20 some 21 years ago now almost.
Right.
And everything since then has just been gravy. So,
Right.
but it does do jhanas, it does archetypes, it can do energy stuff, it can do healing, it can do magical effects. It also does insight things, whatever those are doing. But like I know plenty of people who, when they have done Fire Casino, have gotten what I think of as paths, including
Okay.
some high ones. And so it kind of works on all fronts, but it's kind of unpredictable and exactly what you're going to get. It definitely depends to some degree on how you tune it and what aspect of the colors and visuals and or mantra, et cetera, you tune into. So if you're really paying attention to every little flicker and pulse of the static, it gets more Vipassana. If you're really kind of like trying to smooth things into patterns and creatures and entities and symbols and all that kind of stuff, it gets more sort of shamatha or archetypal. But then insight keeps creeping in. So that it's kind of all of the practices, which is why I find it really interesting, because it kind of seems to work on nearly all fronts, particularly if you add a bodily component into it as well. Then it really becomes much more complete, because then you've got visuals, auditory, and body, and that's a lot of the field.
If somebody's trying to get awakening as
Yeah.
re relatively as soon as possible, would you tell them to focus on fire? I mean, I guess I think it also depends on the person, but would they do
Yeah.
more fire casino or more in insight?
So I did a very interesting month at Dharma Treasure, where I got to see three different groups of people who had showed up to practice with me for that month when I was teaching there as a resident teacher. God, was it 6 years ago now? When was it? Anyway, something like that. And would have been like September, October 2018, somewhere, I think. And there were three groups that were three main groups that showed up to practice. And one wanted to do Mahasi Sayadaw noting. These were not big groups. These are not like sample sizes based on which you could, you know, base things. But one people wanted to do noting Mahasi Sayadaw, three characteristics, six sense doors, really fast perception, tear it all down. Okay, cool. And then a bunch of people ended up wanting to do Fire Casino. And then a bunch of people wanted to do, right, so which
Yeah,
is
mind illuminated.
Mind Illuminated, right? And
Shamatha Vipassana here.
And so the and then I got to watch these people over the month or so, depending on how long they were there, do this thing, and got these sort of very small, again, not great sample size, but just I can tell you the results of this small skewed experiment. And that was that from an insight map point of view, the Mahasi kids and the Fire Casino kids moved as fast as each other from my insight mapping point of view. There were distinct differences. The Mahasi kids were more edgy. They were more precise phenomenologists. They had more like technical classical insights of seeing the intentions that preceded actions and seeing the mental impressions that followed from sense doors and like that kind of Abhidhamic technical analytical thing, they definitely were the best at that because they're doing a practice that just happens to be really conducive to that. But the Fire Casino people moved as fast from an insight stage point of view. From my point of view, they were just way weirder. They were like gathering together and talking about the caterpillar spirit that had taken residence in their spine and, you know, had it been there for too long. And, you know, like the shadow demons that were like snuffing out the stars or whatever. And like, you know, it's like, it's that. And they kind of gathered together into the social group to talk about all the fascinating experiences that they were had. They had the best sense of humor about it, but were definitely the weirdest. Like, and then sure. You had the TMI kids who had neither the technical stuff of the Mahasi kids nor the weird, interesting, magical stuff of the Fire Casino kids. They moved substantially more slowly, maybe at like half the rate of the others, but they also were way more stable. So they didn't have nearly as many fireworks or dramatic insights or highs or lows or openings or energy stuff. They had some, but it was, you know, it's like the slower, safer, not quite as interesting, definitely not as sharp, not as powersy, not as weird, not as technically advanced Vipassana descriptive, but seems safer. So if you were looking for like a slower, safer, more kind of blending concentration in with some kind of thing, you know, so yeah. This kind of depends on what you're looking for. But the fact that the Mahasi stuff, which is known to be like one of the fastest of the insight practices as these things go from my point of view, and the Fire Casino kids were moving at the same rate, I find that really interesting. That's kind of what I found on other retreats too, that would have just been Fire Casino or just Vipassana. When I compare them, not side by side, but like across different retreats I've been on with people, I don't think one is faster than the other, just they have different risk profiles and benefit profiles.
That's really interesting to me because of the Buddhist meditation that I've done, it's been TMI mostly. I did that for a few years pretty intensely, and I didn't really get very far. But it was, nothing bad happened.
Yeah.
That's what I found.
Right. But it's really interesting to me that the Fire Casino you found as effective, because that's the, when I have done your style, I've done more Fire Casino stuff and I really liked it. So maybe I'll do some more of that stuff. But I also
gotta get in high enough dose to get out past the murk to get to the really stuff that I find the most compelling. And that for most people is somewhere between 80 and 150 hours in, you know, at least 6 to 8 hours a day, if not higher. So
yeah. So you have to be on retreat.
On retreat. Yeah.
It's not like people can't get cool effects off of retreat. I have and other people have, but I don't know anybody who off retreat gets reproducibly to the what the high end looks like.
Yeah. And it's a very high concentration practice too. So does that fall off pretty quickly after retreat?
Yes.
As well. Yeah.
Although the weird effects may not. So that's the funny thing. So just because the concentration power falls off doesn't mean the weird effects it can produce might not fall off. Which
like the sensitivity span, still on your spine for a few weeks or something.
You get the idea. It's a wide range of very weird effects. And it's like, I should also say this high dose stuff, and particularly like Fire Casino, like the first talk I give on retreats in case people are wanting to plunge off and do this is not safe. And I'm not saying that to inspire people. Oh, it's not safe. I want to go do this. I'm saying it's not safe. Like, just recognize this is high risk practice. It can do very weird things to your operating system. You're rewriting the code while the operating system is still running. That can go very strangely in the short, medium, sometimes even long term. I've had all kinds of weird effects that lingered sometimes for weeks after these retreats, not all of which were pleasant, some of which were amazing. It's all over the place. Just go in with eyes open and, you know, check out the Fire Casino website and try to read and get a sense of the territory. And even then, like, we don't totally know how to make this fully safe.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me also a big part of it is, and this is what like Richard Rohr's tradition that I've been doing a lot of work that I've been doing, is like self-inquiry and like looking at issues, you know, looking at belief structures, you know, frameworks, that kind of stuff. There's a lot of stuff a lot of people generally have. I mean, some people don't have a bunch of stuff, but most people do. And I think that's the kind of stuff that can really get in the way, especially in like magical practice, visionary practice. If you haven't dealt with it, I think that makes it more dangerous. So what makes things more dangerous is if all that stuff comes up and you're not prepared for it.
So would you recommend having a teacher like with you, or you're just saying sort of like heads up, this could be dangerous, just be aware?
Well, Like if you were going to climb Mount Everest or go skydiving or something, if you're going to go skydiving, do you want to be jumping out of the plane on your own or do you want to jump in tent? Do you want to, if you're going climbing Everest, do you want some good Sherpas with you? Or you just want to see what happens when you start walking up the mountain. Like this is kind of that, right? So like people who have done this before, people who have a sense of the territory, people who have some capacity to deal with the weird, people who have done a lot of psychedelics and been really good trip sitters. That's the kind of people you want around when you're doing this. Not necessarily a teacher. Actually, I know almost nobody who's actually doing retreats and teaching this stuff. So good luck. But, you know, reaching out and finding people who have done this, have some sense of the territory, who have their heads screwed on straight and can lend some guidance capacity. You know, like when I did my solo fire casino retreat, I had two friends who had done this before with me spot me, like, and saying they were on call in case I ran into something weird. And I think of myself as a competent explorer on the path, but I also appreciate that that doesn't mean you can't break your leg or whatever. And it's not just the psychological stuff. There's also powerful, energetic, perceptual, physiological, weird stuff that can happen. We've had all kinds of strange reports from like serious dizziness and nausea to weird. Like I got into one thing where I came back from a 12-day, very intensive fire casino retreat back into, you know, working shifts in the emergency department. And about an hour into every shift for 3 weeks thereafter, I started feeling like I had the flu. This was not psychological. This was physical. I felt awful. I felt physically toxic. And that went on for 3 weeks. And as soon as I would leave the ER, it'd be gone within like 10 minutes.
So there's like
psychological, maybe, but the physiological effects of it were quite profound. Or a recent retreat. So I just went on a recent two fire casino retreats, actually. And the first one was not that deep. It was like lower dose for me. It was like 6 to 8 hours and some talking. And 2 days after it, after the retreat ended, I shifted into the space that was like a mix of like amazed wide-eyed wonder, but also no filters to the dark absurdity of humanity. So like finding myself in the Chiang Mai airport, like walking past the duty free shop, I was like, oh my God, this sparkly poison, these pretty sparkly people selling government subsidized poison. Like, this is terrible. And wow, these sparkling gold cases and lights are so amazingly pretty. I was in that state for a week. Like, this is not okay. I was navigating Chiang Mai and airports and hotels and stuff. And like, but it was jarring. Like, it was like being a tripping person. And it just finally faded. Nothing I did anything to it. Wow. Like, it was just.
Had to run its course.
Yeah, just had to move through. And is that psychological? No, that was perceptual, filtery. Like, that's structural.
Yeah.
The same way as doing psychedelics. Like, psychedelics can linger and produce some long-lasting, strange effects. This is that. Okay. This is structural.
Well, apparently when you're, like, Kundalini can trigger ductless gland kind of stuff. And, like, a lot of early people in the West who did Kundalini without teachers, you know, had died, you know, because of those kind of effects too. So I think that might be part of it too, triggering energetic things. But I want to ask this question. Is, from your perspective, is awakening a function of practice or technical ability?
Definitely for some.
Okay.
So, and then there are other people who just seem the wind blows and they wake up, and even as kids, right? Like,
right.
So they didn't do technical anything. And then there are other people who you give them all this technical stuff and they just find it jarring and disconcerting and gets them away from the intuitive, feel into it, flowy kind of practitioner that they are, which maybe is the faster, much better way for them. And then there are other people who just kind of flounder and finally find technique and all of a sudden are just off and running. So there's a wide range of the relationship between technique and technical capability and progress. And it is not straightforward or linear.
Yeah, that's what I've found so far too. But there, I mean, everyone has a different history, different birth chart, you know, there's different things are triggering different things. I do want to ask you a question because you've done a lot of work in the magic realm, and in the West there is this tradition of theurgy and like people like Iamblichus and so on, and even the Golden Dawn folks use ritual. Do you think that's an effective method? Have you worked with that or experimented with that at all?
We're going to have a little bit of moment with my Buddhist roots here. So one of the first defilements that in theory falls away at stream entry is the belief in rites and rituals as the way to awaken. Okay. Uh-huh. Yeah. That you must do rites and rituals. And if you do these rites and rituals, you awaken. And if you don't do them, then you won't awaken. And that it is dependent on rites and rituals that one awakens. That said, I know people who have awakened during rites and rituals. Now, what's the causality of that? And was it also their clear perception of the ritual? Was it the ritual shifted them into space that when they could then, you know, where then all of the previous training they had coalesced into something? Was it, I know people who during ceremonies with powerful people who could transmit, like where woof, they got something, right? That's a thing. Transmission is a thing, as I mentioned in the writing thing that I did. And so it is complicated. And I definitely know people who rituals were an important part of how they got realization. And I also know people who did tons and tons of rituals and never got any obvious insights beyond getting really good at rituals. So again, there's a range out there, but I would say that rituals can definitely facilitate shifts in consciousness, clear perception, openings to other ways of being. They can reframe, a good ritual can reframe, can lay the groundwork, can help precipitate stuff sometimes for some people. Were I to bet purely on ritual or vipassana, I would bet on vipassana. But do I think people who are doing or something like that, whatever, some kind of, you know, direct insight tradition that's really going for the heart of the thing. But do I also think that some people doing a direct insight tradition, which is really going for the heart of insight in some kind of technical way, some of those people really do benefit from ritual work or adding it or augmenting it, or later on they did all this thing and then it was a ritual that helped it, you know, come to fruition, as it were. Again, complicated.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Very individual, right, as well.
On a different note, I wanted to ask you what the role of dreams has been on your spiritual path.
Yeah, dreams is where I really started in some ways. So I had my first lucid flying dream at age 5, and I remember it exactly. I swam up into the air. It was Raleigh, North Carolina, in a little house we were living in there in the suburbs, and it was very striking. Have you all had flying dreams?
Oh yeah.
More so of a bicycle than like a swimmer.
I swim in the air.
Interesting.
Yeah, I like to ride a bike.
There you go. So got it. So I have a bunch of different flying modes and swimming is just one of them. Actually, I don't swim that often. I have the like where you put your hand out forward and you're kind of like intentional directing that way. I have the push off mode where it's like almost like I have energy jets coming out of my feet or like anti-gravity out of my feet. I have I have the jumping mode where I can jump and go jump incredible distances, like or skating mode where I can kind of start skating and I just kind of skate up into the air like ice skating or roller skating.
Okay, yep.
So I've got there's a range of different flying modes anyway, but dreams were super important because it was actually trying to have better flying dreams that I had my first massive opening that really got me into this stuff in some really established sort of a way. And I was visualizing so I wanted to have better flying dreams. So I was imagining before I went to sleep for maybe 20, 30 minutes each night. I don't know where I got this. As far as I can tell, I just kind of home brewed it. I don't think anybody taught anything like this to me. But I was visualizing these like 50-foot billiard balls in space of different colors. And I would fly it kind of like small planets. Mm-hmm. And I would fly up to one and visualize myself touching it. And then I would turn around and turn my attention away from it and fly towards another one and touch it. And anyway, and trying to visualize that really, really well was enough meditative chops to get to my first major opening, which also happened in a dream. So it was in the dream that my consciousness really exploded into particles flying all over my room for the first time. And yeah, really seemed to have been an important, like there's a before and after in my life, before and after that moment. And they're very different things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. How about you all?
So cool. Yeah. I'm an avid dreamer and I found that visualizing before bed and making the intention of remembering my dreams and writing them down first thing in the morning has really helped my dream practice. And it's interesting how dreams can influence the waking life. And sometimes it's hard to tell the difference.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah. I like dreaming too. I haven't made it as much of a, I've had it more of a practice, but I kind of just like, you know, when there's a really important dream, that's that I write that down, you know, mm-hmm. and I enjoy the, when I'm on retreat, dreams are a lot more lucid, something like that. But most of the time, it's not too big of a thing for me. But I do love flying dreams. Those are the best feeling ever. Yeah. For sure. Yeah. So this has really been a fantastic conversation, and I really appreciate your time. I know you don't have very much time. You're a very busy man. So I appreciate that. And and answering these questions, having a conversation with us. People can find your
Thanks.
Book.
It's been fun.
Thank you.
So people can find your book for free on the internet, as well as buy a physical copy from Aeon. Where can they find you? And are you open to contact or no?
So you can find the book at mctb.org. You can find my website at integrateddaniel.info or interactivebuddha.com. They go to the same place. You can find the Dharma Overground, which is a forum that I co-founded with Vince Horn, at dharmaoverground.org. You can find the Fire Casino website at firekasina.org, firecasino with a K.org. You can find, I've got a bunch on my main website. You'll find a link tree that goes to a bunch of other sites, some open science data and the EPRC and emergence, all kinds of places and things I'm working on these days. So that's the first thing. And in terms of people reaching out to me, so I for almost 30 years, I guess like 27 years or something, I guess, I've said, hey, you know, all calls, all emails, I will take them. I've recently come to realize I'm just like getting too far behind on these things. So on my website, there is contact information, but recognize that like I just found myself literally responding to emails from 6 months ago and saying, hey, I'm sorry, it took me a while to get to you. That's obviously a sign of an overcommitted life. I explicitly don't want to be anybody's teacher. So like nearly all people who talk with me, they talk with me once and I'll refer them to a bunch of people and resources and books and other teachers. I'm not looking to be anybody's guru. I don't take any money for this. I don't even take donations. I put all my stuff out there for free. So like, hey, find the stuff, go practice. This is on you. Here's a bunch of resources. Here's a community. Here's a bunch of other teachers. Here's a bunch of books that I reference. Y'all have fun, kids. And so, but you know, like I sometimes talk to people, you know, like just talk to somebody right before this call who was, you know, wondering about their meditation practice and trauma and stuff like that. So I do, you know, end up doing what is usually like a few calls a week. So maybe like 150 people a year or something I end up talking with. And I respond to some emails and things when I can. But recognize that at this point with the EPRC and emergence benefactors, I get way behind. And if I do nothing personal, it's just my totally overcommitted life to reasonably attempt to manage expectations. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah. Thank you for doing that too, and helping in all the ways that you do. So yeah. Really appreciate it.
Cool.
It was really nice to chat with you, Daniel. Thank you so much.
It's really fun. Thank you all. All right. Bye.
Bye.